1039 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. It is Feldis and Kale, and we are proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. And we'll be chatting with Amy Hall, who is the executive director of Granite State Dairy Promotion, a little bit later on in the program. But first, in the leadoff spot, as it were, is Anna Brown, who is the Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count and citizenscount.org. They have a great Facebook page as well. And Anna, welcome back to Feldis and Kale.
Great to be here.
Well, it's always a delight to have you. And I'll let you and Dan chat away about this one. I know the state budget was passed in the House, and now it goes on to the Senate. But apparently, Governor Sununu still has many concerns about the way the budget is looking right now.
Here's the thing. We are not in an unusual situation where the House is producing a budget that, frankly, probably is not going to be what the final product looks like by the time it gets to the governor. We've seen times in the past where the House actually failed to pass a budget because they couldn't agree. Of course, last time around, the budget got vetoed by Governor Sununu, and then we had to come back. So I am expecting a lot of changes to happen when the budget now moves to the Senate. What is surprising, though, is how contrary the House was to the governor. It definitely seems like they made a point to put some things in there that cannot possibly make it all the way to the end, since Governor Sununu has said flat out, if you include some of these restrictions on emergency powers, if you include this ban on critical race theory, you know, I'm probably going to veto it. So it's interesting to see what the end goal is.
Dan, what were your thoughts on the budget?
Well, look, I think this was a budget that was crafted to cater to the far right of one political party. I think that the ban on critical race theory, the emergency powers, but also the tax cuts, which I think Governor Chris Sununu supports, the phasing out the interest and dividends tax, which over 80% of the benefit of that would go to the top 10% earners in the state. You have to make hundreds of thousands of dollars. You have to have a savings account of hundreds of thousands of dollars before you even pay this thing. And most people I know don't get dividends payouts. Ken, I don't. Do you?
No, I don't. I don't, as a matter of fact.
I don't know who gets dividends payouts for big corporations. So getting rid of that tax entirely, cutting education funding by $100 million, cutting HHS, Health and Human Services, by $80 million in a pandemic. Health and Human Services? Are you kidding me? I mean, this budget does not protect public health. This budget is going to increase property taxes. So let alone the stuff that Governor Sununu is fired up about, which is limiting his authority a little bit in a pandemic. I don't think he said he would veto the entire budget over the ban on critical race theory, but he's fired up about the limits on his authority. He's not fired up about cutting education funding, increasing property taxes. He's not fired up about those things. Unless I'm wrong, Anna, I thought he said he would veto it only over the provision to limit his authority.
Well, the interesting thing is he was also saying some yesterday that he is concerned that it will not balance, just in general, that some of these numbers are just off, which is tricky, because the thing that's interesting is that Governor Sununu had his budget proposal, and the final spending coming out of the House budget is lower than what he was saying. They went and cut it even further, and that does seem to be raising his hackles a little bit. He didn't speak specifically, as far as I know, about the Health and Human Services cuts, for example, which were quite extensive, but definitely there's some math concerns that he has, although I don't think it was too specific.
Well, I mean, he gave non-specific math concerns when he vetoed the budget presented the last time around, and in fact, he said it wasn't balanced and it spent too much, and the final budget agreement spent more, and he signed it. So I'm not sure. You're absolutely right, Anna. Who knows how this process unfolds, but it is very much inning two or three, maybe four, of the budget process. There's a lot to go here.
It's never a walk in the park, is it? It's never easy. I mean, you know, one would think, I mean, you know, I certainly don't know nearly as much about the process as you guys do, but one would think when you have a Republican majority in the House and in the Senate, the budget would be kind of an easy thing, but apparently it's not.
Oh, no. No. I feel that. Here's the thing. The budget in New Hampshire is always particularly tricky because we have one of the lowest state government spending per capita in the U.S., for better or worse. Some people think that's great. Some people think that's terrible. It definitely means that when it comes time to sit down and allocate your spending, you're always not going to be able, as a lawmaker, you want it to be Christmas for everyone, right? You want to be able to make everyone in your district happy, and you can't. You just can't. You have to pick and choose. So it doesn't surprise me very much at all that there's a lot of contention, even within a single party, about where the spending goes. Two things I did want to tease out that I thought haven't necessarily been getting as much attention, but are kind of interesting and to me, in that they haven't gotten a lot of attention. Is so this legalizing historic horse racing, I think that's really interesting because, so for people who may not know, it sounds funny, historic horse racing, how could you lose? Sounds like a great deal. But there's these electronic terminals where you get limited details about a race that happened in the past, so you can't know what race it was, and then you bet. And the critics say this is very much like slot machines. It's going to be a real problem in New Hampshire for problem gambling. Supporters say this is going to support our charitable gaming. It's going to give more funding for schools, more funding for charities. It's going to help our economy. So this has been a proposal for years and never really gained traction. It's in the budget. They passed it yesterday. It sailed through. An identical bill has passed the Senate. So that's a change, an expanded gambling change that I feel has not gotten a lot of attention, which in other years might be getting a lot of attention. And then the other thing that's interesting is what's going on with a new forensic psychiatric hospital, because the state right now is facing a lawsuit over the fact that it doesn't have a secure psychiatric facility for people. So there are some patients who are being housed in the state prison. There's a lawsuit over this. And so in the last budget, there was some funding to build a new secure facility. Well, COVID-19 postponed that. And now I'm not seeing that in this new budget that's going through. So there's sort of that was a huge debate, once again, 2 years ago that I'm not seeing much about. So that's just kind of two interesting details to tease out.
Well, on the last one, there's lawsuits in terms of not providing the kind of services to make sure that people aren't hospitalized for mental health reasons. We have an emergency room waiting list of now 80 people sitting in emergency rooms waiting for mental health care. You don't do that if you have a broken ankle or heart attack. I mean, this is unconscionable, but we spent in the last budget, we did a number of things, including mobile crisis teams that were not stood up by Governor Sununu, statewide mobile crisis to prevent people from going to the emergency rooms. And we funded the secure psychiatric hospital, as Anna just mentioned. And Governor Sununu actually cut it unilaterally out of the budget in April of 2020. And then he proposed a new proposal without limitation on who could build it. Keep in mind the limitation, the crux of this one is the limitation we put in that budget, Ken and Anna, was that the private prison industry shall not construct or manage the mental health hospital. And Chris Sununu mentioned privately to other folks, he didn't like that limitation. He ended up unilaterally cutting the funding for the secure psychiatric hospital and then proposes in his budget proposal a 60-bed unit, which is far greater than what's needed, and no limitation on who could build it or manage it. And the House Finance Committee, as Anna mentioned, took it out. Republicans and Democrats took it out. So it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds.
Anna Brown is with us. Anna is the Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, citizenscount.org. You should check it out if you haven't already. We have to take a break here at 103.9, 1450 WKXL, nhtalkradio.com. Feldis and Kale, proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. Welcome back. 103.9, 1450 WKXL, nhtalkradio.com. Feldis and Kale, presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. Our guest, Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, citizenscount.org. And, you know, Anna, you sparked my attention there by talking about the historic horse racing. And I'm just going to go off on a bit of a tangent here just very quickly, Anna. And Dan, let me do it for 1 second here that... You know, I've always been a strong proponent of expanded gaming in the state of New Hampshire. We had the best location in New England for a casino in Salem, which pretty much is just an extension of Massachusetts anyway, so why not take advantage of the location? Great access, too. But, you know, when you have all the charitable gaming that's going on right now, and I agree with Senator D'Alessandro that not enough of that charitable gaming money is going to the state. I'm certainly in agreement with him on that. You have the charitable gaming everywhere, and now you have Keno, and now apparently we're going to have historic horse racing. Pandora's box, folks, has been opened up. And I just think it's time again to perhaps, you know, look at, expanding it even more. So that's my rant for the day. That's all. And now I will let you guys get back to more serious conversation. Not that I'm not serious about it, because I am, but more information that is going to help guide our pathway to great success in this state. And generally speaking, it's been a busy week for New Hampshire legislators.
Oh, my goodness. It's marathon. I can't remember a time I've seen a House calendar this long, because they haven't been meeting in person or virtually, for that matter. 400 of them would have been hard either way. I'm sure that Dan can touch on. There's lawsuits going on. There's a lot of complexity there. But the moral of the story is, usually they meet every week. Haven't been doing that. So they met yesterday, they're meeting today, they're meeting tomorrow, and it's going to be incredible to see if they can vote on all of the bills they're planning on voting on, all within the deadlines, without doing, you know, crazy late nights. I remember last year, the last night they were voting before the legislature shut down because of COVID-19, it went way into the night, you know, way past 5 p.m., and they're in a private facility now, so I don't know if they're going to get kicked out. But, you know, there's all sorts of bills that are getting voted on that may have slipped under the radar because the budget was just so huge and they're voting on so many at once. So, you know, there's a bill about paying for unused vacation time at jobs, you know, what sort of the policy needs to be there. The building code for tiny houses, you know, if towns have to accept tiny houses within certain areas.
Tiny houses, big debate.
I tell you what, it's interesting. We were a little surprised. We threw a question out there. We actually did a podcast episode as well on that bill. And it was one of our most popular ones this year. People get so fired up about tiny houses. And I don't know if it's because New Hampshire has an affordable housing crisis, and so they're just really eager for a solution, or if it's just we've all seen those, you know, tiny house, big life shows on HTV, GTV, and the Discovery Channel, and we sort of love that look that we see on Instagram and Pinterest. But yeah, so, you know, also vehicle emission standards. I mean, you name it, it's on the menu for these 3 days.
And certainly, and one thing that was not put on the calendar, Anna, that who knows when the House Republican leadership might bring it up, is so-called right to work. What is the status of that? Why wasn't it put on the calendar?
Yes, and so the interesting thing there is it already passed the Senate, as we know.
Yep.
But uncertain fate in the House, uncertain. We have seen in the past that Republican legislatures in New Hampshire, the House in particular, has failed to pass right to work because there are some Republicans who have union backgrounds look at this and they say, you know what, no, this is interfering in private contracts. We don't want to do it. It's a little tricky, and I suspect that they held that off because they wanted to be able to, you know, work with their caucus and try to marshal the votes. I don't know about you, Dan, off the top of my head, I'm not remembering that Sununu has weighed in on that issue this year. And I know that in the past he was a very strong supporter of right to work, but didn't work out so great because the Republican House last time around did not pass it.
Yeah, no, I haven't heard him weigh in on it this time around. However, you know, in his first inaugural address, if you may recall, in early 2017, the only specific public policy that he mentioned was so-called right to work and that people needed to get it done. And you may recall I went into the Republican House caucus and said, you're either a Republican or a Democrat. You need to stick with me on so-called right to work. And that rubbed the pro-union, pro-labor Republicans the wrong way. And it backfired. And we were able to stop so-called right to work and stand up for working people. And so, I don't know. It sounds like it's just a little odd that it's not put on the calendar. And I don't know what the the strategy there is. But I, you're right. I haven't heard him specifically weigh in, and maybe because he specifically weighed in last time and it backfired, he's holding back.
I have to wonder. I have to wonder, since it didn't work out so well. And there's the other thing, of course, is we're seeing, as we were just talking a few minutes ago, that certain right wing of the party that is, frankly, anti-Sununu. Anti-Sununu, I think it's fair to say. And so definitely, I think if he was in favor of anything, there's a chance that they would kind of want a two-bit. So.
Yeah, and one of the things yesterday, Anna, I didn't catch all, I didn't catch the debates at all, but I did see that Representative Sharon Norgren did a floor amendment on the budget to restore that back of the budget cut of $80 million to Health and Human Services, which results in about over 200 positions being erased and programs likely being cut significantly in a pandemic, public health programming. What was the nature of that debate, if you heard it, on the floor? Because you would think that Republicans would be supporting public health in a pandemic, you would hope, but certainly that's not ultimately what happened. What if you caught the debate on that floor amendment, what was it like?
Sure. I only caught part of that debate, but this is also a debate that was happening in the Finance Committee meetings. There was a lot of concern that why are we cutting Health and Human Services in the middle of COVID-19? You would think that now is the time. And there's a couple interesting dynamics that came out. The first one is I've heard from several Republicans who have testified on this, and their argument is basically this department is growing too fast. The tricky thing here is New Hampshire also has an aging population.
Yep.
So New Hampshire is, and this is a long-term challenge for New Hampshire. This is not new, and it's not going to go away anytime soon. So we are having more people who are needing health care, who are going to be enrolling in Medicare, who are they going to need assisted living? Are they going to need home health care? So this, you know, people argue this is part of the reason why that budget is growing so much, is because this is a factor of what's happening with our population. And another interesting factor that I feel complicates this is, so Republicans are saying, all right, these positions we're cutting are vacant. Well, the problem is New Hampshire has a workforce shortage right now.
Yep.
New Hampshire is having trouble filling its positions. So I think that, you know, doing the two sides of the debate, the ones the Republicans are arguing, this department is, their budget is ballooning, and we're cutting things that aren't even filled, so it shouldn't have an impact. But the other side of that is, well, the budget is growing, and they can't fill those positions because New Hampshire has an aging population and a workforce shortage. So there, you know, it's a little bit of New Hampshire's constant problem of the budget, which is we're on a 2-year budget cycle. We're always sort of putting out fires, I think, with our budget. And it can be very difficult to look at problems from a long-term perspective when you're only looking at those next few years.
Right. And one of the things, Anna, was developed over the years with the emergency room boarding crisis, again, the mental health crisis in the state, which was exacerbated by the pandemic, but a lot of bipartisan work went into it in 2015, 2016, 2017. And part of what our Republican colleagues had said at that time is, like, let's hold off a little bit on some of these more aggressive long-term planning measures until some of these studies came in. The Adequacy and Enhancement Report came in July of 2018. It recommended a comprehensive children's system of care, including a statewide mobile crisis team for kids. We put that into legislation. There was some grumbling from the Sununu administration about it. It passed. Fortunately, he signed it ultimately, and then it was concluded and funded in the budget. But this is a long-term, agreed-upon, bipartisan solution of a statewide mobile crisis for children, a system of care, and it was not stood up. It was funded, and it would mitigate costs down the road, including ER boarding, mental health crisis. And was that discussed at length at all, the mental health situation, mobile crisis, based on your following of the House Finance Committee and on the floor of the House yesterday?
Like I said, well, the mental health issues have come up. They have not been as prominent in the debates as I expected they would be, because, like, you go back 2 years or even 4 years, there was so much pressure on that issue, the mm-hmm. idea that New Hampshire has underfunded its mental health system for years and years and years. We're going to get in trouble with federal lawsuits. We need, this is a crisis. We have people in emergency rooms. And while I see in particular, you know, the Twitterverse is the Twitterverse. It's its own world. But nonetheless, I've seen that there's a lot of people, I think, that are talking on Twitter about how this emergency boarding situation, I haven't seen that playing out as much in these floor debates. And frankly, I think it's a little bit of a bummer when you look at the balance of time where people are spending a lot of their debate. I think it ended up being on some of these more controversial non-budgetary items when you're looking at the bill related to critical race theory, when you're looking at the governor's emergency powers. I think that those kind of took away from more in-depth debates about the mental health system and what isn't getting funded, since some things did get frozen or cut during the COVID-19 emergency because the state was kind of like, I don't know, we might not have any tax money at all going forward. So that's, it's too bad. It's too bad.
Yeah. Well, I think that, Ken and I talked offline a little bit about this, but like, look, you want to talk about controversial stuff like voting rights and some of this other stuff, focusing on the bread and butter, the problems that face Granite Staters, the mental health system, which, again, I don't understand why Sununu and his administration did not stand up that comprehensive children's system of care and statewide mobile crisis to alleviate the pressure on emergency rooms. The mental health system, education, property taxes, helping workers and working families, particularly in this pandemic, and small businesses. And so those bread and butter issues, I think, Anna, seem to have kind of taken to some degree, a back burner by the advancement of some of these controversial issues.
And I guess the question is that going to change in the Senate? You know, the state Senate often is, they've been chugging along with there's only 24 of them. They've been meeting virtually. So Governor Sununu seems to put a lot of faith in them. I've heard him say more than once that I'm trusting the Senate's going to do their job, clean this budget up, blah, blah, blah. So it'll be interesting to see. I wonder if just right away at the beginning, I wonder, will they just take out a few of these controversial amendments and then sort of that'll be it? Or I wonder if these debates are going to be pressed forward and linger.
And one of the controversial amendments, Anna, was the amendment to functionally defund Planned Parenthood and other family planning organizations in the state. That has been, New Hampshire is one of, there's overwhelming bipartisan support for a woman's right to choose. And that amendment was put into the budget. It's a very controversial amendment. It would be the first time that has ever passed in New Hampshire. And defunding Planned Parenthood is not a popular thing in New Hampshire. Has the governor weighed in on that specifically?
This is an interesting one because Governor Sununu identifies as pro-choice, and really the only sort of legislative test of that, if you will, wasn't even really legislation, but was when he was on the executive council. There was one time when he voted against a contract for Planned Parenthood because at this time that video had come out that was allegedly arguing that Planned Parenthood was selling fetal tissue or fetal body parts, if I remember correctly. I don't remember exactly the video. Most of the video was debunked, and so he basically ended up reversing his vote at a later date and said, yeah, we can go forward with this contract. But at the time, he said, no, I want to hold off. I want to see what's going on with this video. So that was kind of the only test of his pro-choice identity. And I have noticed as this debate has gone forward, which just for listeners, if they're not familiar, what the amendment would do, would it would require any women's health clinics that offer abortion to have it at a physically separate location, not just financially separate, because usually there's that separation. No public funds can go to abortion. But the idea is, well, if it's paying for the lights, then it's indirectly supporting abortion. But of course, that would be having an entirely separate location is very cost prohibitive. So that's just a sideline, what this amendment does. So Governor Sununu, I have not heard weigh in on this. And one has to wonder if the Senate does keep this in, what is Sununu going to do? I feel it's going to be the first time he's really challenged on that issue position. And but I also don't know what the Senate is going to do, because there are a few other bills that have been proposed this year to restrict access to abortion in one way or another. But they're coming out of the House. They're coming out of the House. And so none of those bills that I have seen have had a vote in the Senate yet. So it's also hard to know where they're going to swing on this.
Yeah, and I think there was one other test, Anna, to Governor Sununu's self-identified pro-choice, quote-unquote, status, which, by the way, I mean, I can identify as being 7'5". It doesn't mean I'm 7'5". I'm actually 5'10", a little bit more than that. So you can say things, and it doesn't necessarily be true. One other test, Anna, was his veto, you may recall, of legislation in the summer of 2020 requiring insurance carriers cover the full range of reproductive health care services, including abortion health care services, requiring insurance carriers do that. I would argue that was another test of it, but I haven't heard him talk about that. This specific defund, functionally defunding Planned Parenthood in the budget. Have you heard any comment from Senate Republicans about how they're going to treat that provision when it comes over to the Senate?
I have not. And in fact, I have not seen any really prominent comments from Republican senators, period, about what the House has done with the budget right now. I imagine that they want to keep relations cordial because ultimately they do need to get those House votes back in. So I can only speculate what they may or may not be sharing their opinions, you know, privately. But like I said, you know, it's the abortion issue in particular, since we're talking about it, difficult as well to speculate without any other votes to go on this year. Definitely we know that there are plenty of Republican senators who identify as pro-life, who may favor these things, but it goes, you know, I feel like pro-life, pro-choice, they are clear words, they're clear identities, but I feel like for many legislators in the New Hampshire House and Senate, there does end up being a little bit of gray area. They may be a little bit like Sununu, where at one point they'd vote against a Planned Parenthood contract, but then they'd change their vote, you know? And I think that there are some moderate Republicans in the Senate that, you know, they could swing either way. There are some people I know for sure who would support something like that, but there's just that gray area.
Just have a minute or two left with Anna Brown, who is the Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, citizenscount.org. And after this week, what becomes of the New Hampshire legislature? What's the upcoming schedule?
Well, I imagine everyone in the New Hampshire House is going to take a 3-day nap. But they still have to deal with all of the bills that have passed the Senate at this point. So we're going to go back to, there's going to be a lot of public hearings on all of these Senate bills, and of course the House is going to be voting, doing the same thing with Senate bills. It's not just the the Senate is going to be doing the same thing with the House bill. So it's not just the budget. The Senate has to deal with all those other House bills that they get passed yesterday, today, and tomorrow. So definitely people can go to our website, citizenscount.org, and they can browse all of the bills by topic. You know, we try to keep people up to date on hot issues that are popping up on our Facebook page. So it's a lot to keep track of. There's, you know, probably close to 1,000 bills this year.
You have some great poll questions on the Facebook page. What has been drawing, interest in recent days on your poll questions?
I tell you what, even though I think everybody is getting really tired of COVID-19, those are often still the policy questions we ask that get the highest response. So when we're looking at mask mandates, when we're looking about whether or not schools should be required to go back in person, this concept of vaccine passports, you know, what private businesses can do, what the state can do, the governor's emergency powers, those definitely seem like the people are still most concerned about those. And I think that is also backed up when you look at the Granite State poll. Every now and then they do poll about what's the most pressing issue in New Hampshire right now, and COVID-19 still wins, which is, you know, it's not terribly surprising. We're all still, you know, the vaccines are still very new and just rolling out. I think that we're only about like 1/5, I think, are fully vaccinated at this point. So, yeah, you know, we haven't, I feel like this is the first time we're talking about it today, but it's still obviously a really big policy challenge.
No doubt about it. Anna Brown, as always, a delight to have you with us. Very informative. And enjoyed your discussion with Dan, and lots of great information. And look forward to having you back in the not-too-distant future.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Ken.
You got it.
All right, Anna Brown. And Anna is, she is so well-informed. She's the Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, citizenscount.org. 103.9, 1450, WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. It's Feldis and Kale. And we are proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. 103.9, 1450, WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com, Feldison Kale, proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. And joining us right now is the Executive Director of Granite State Dairy Promotion, Amy Hall. Amy, how are you today?
I am doing wonderful. How are you, gentlemen?
Great. It's great to have you on, Amy.
Thank you, Dan. I love being here. Two of my favorite guys. It's a great, great day.
And I didn't let Dan in on the fact, Amy, that we might be talking a little romance in this segment of the program. And I asked you yesterday if there was any specific thing that you wanted to talk about this morning and as we tape Feldison Kale. And you said, you know, the relationship, the true, you know, as you are a true romantic, we're going to discuss how much dairy farmers love their cows.
Oh, it's one of my favorite subjects. And Ken, you made me laugh so hard last night with that message. I thank you for that. It was a good belly laugh. I loved it. But, you know, this is a subject that's near and dear to my heart, and it's also frustrating at the same time. I just want to back up a little into, if it's okay, go around the barn, if you will.
That's good. That's good.
Of my history, and I think, you know, one of the greatest benefits in this job is the fact that when I came into this, I took a marketing position, right? It was a career in marketing and something that I absolutely loved. I didn't know anything about dairy farming. The only thing I knew is that I grew up playing barn tag at Kentucky Creamery right around the corner from my house. So, you know, unfortunately, when I came into this job, there was a lot of things that I had heard about the industry. Everything from antibiotics in milk to hormones to all of those hot topic issues that you hear. And, of course, cow care and comfort was one of them. And not knowing the actual reality, I think that's a real benefit here for me. Because once you're immersed in the industry, you get a completely different understanding of what it is, and you're able to look beyond those sensationalized headlines. And cow care is one of those things. Not that I ever believed that cows were treated poorly, it was just a question I had. And I can say that I have been on 95% of the dairy farms in this state, and it brings me to my knees sometimes watching these farmers and their relationship with the cows and how well they treat these girls. They literally are, and this is not just lip service, part of their family. They are their family. And I'll never forget the day, and I'm not going to mention the farmer because these are, you know, very strong people. I was on a farm and we were doing a video shoot, something to put up on our website. And I happened to be down at the other end of the barn, and I saw the farmer just start to rub one of his cows under her neck, kind of like you do a dog, right? And you scratch their ear, and he was talking to her, "You're such a good girl, what a good girl." And then he just sort of moves down the line and does that. And I watched the cows line up for him. And I know that that might seem insignificant to some people, but it's those honest, candid moments that sort of blow you away.
Yeah, I'm sure they do. And, you know, Amy, do many of these cows have names?
They do. They do. And here's another fun thing. Well, I'll get to this. Lorraine Merrill, if you remember, she used to be the Commissioner of Agriculture
She was wonderful, wonderful commissioner.
She is such a wonderful, wonderful lady, and her and I had a great relationship. And what a lot of farms do is they take a line of cows based on who the dad or who the mom is of that line. And they name them after specific subjects or items. And Lorraine, she had my favorite. She had a line of fine tea. So she had an Earl Grey. She had a breakfast. And that's how she named her cows, all based on tea names. Then we have another who have a line, believe it or not, a line of Amy's. And let me tell you what an honor that is.
Wow.
It's to have a line of Amy's named after you. It's kind of funny and cute, but a lot of dairy farmers do that. And it's cool. It really is cool to see. Not all dairy producers do that. It's easier for them to keep track of them by their license number. That doesn't mean that those cows are loved any less. But these are larger farms. So you're talking about farms like Forb Farms up in Lancaster, our largest farm, who milks about 900 cows. Wow. I mean, keeping track of the names of 900 cows, I would imagine, is nearly impossible. But again, just because they don't have names doesn't mean they're loved any less.
Yeah. How do you have a line of Amy's? I mean, is there different iterations of your name that were used, or is it Amy 1, Amy 2, Amy 3?
Oh, no. There are different iterations of my name thrown in there. Some of them I'm willing to share. Others are just funny inside jokes based on my relationship with certain farmers. But there's a crazy Amy. There's a sleepy Amy.
Okay.
There's a very busy Amy. And then there's one that may or may not like to enjoy an outside beverage that doesn't involve dairy, Amy.
Okay.
It's fun. But, you know, here's what it comes down to is that, you know, treating cows and animals with respect and compassion, it's just a part of every dairy farmer's heritage. You could not be a livestock farmer of any kind if you didn't have a true love and connection to animals. They recognize, our farmers, that excellent animal welfare practices lead to nothing more than the production of high-quality milk. And that's what they do. They feed their communities, and they want to make sure that in order to feed their communities healthy, local, fresh foods, the very start of that begins with their cows. And it doesn't make any sense to treat their cows poorly or with any less love and respect than we would treat our beloved dog or our beloved cat.
Yeah, and certainly New Hampshire's dairy farmers engage in the very best practices, including animal care, and are so vital, obviously, to our economy more generally. But engaging in those practices is something that I don't think a lot of folks know, and I think that's part why this conversation is a good one.
Yeah, Amy Hall is with us. She is the executive director of Granite State Dairy Promotion, our title sponsor here on Feldis and Kale, along with our local dairy farmers here in New Hampshire. We'll take a quick break, then be back. Feldis and Kale, 1039, 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. 1039, 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. Feldis and Kale, presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. Amy Hall is here, Executive Director of Granite State Dairy Promotion. And you talked about the fact that one of the farms in Lancaster had 900 cows, the largest dairy farm in the state of New Hampshire. What was the name of that farm again?
It is Forbes Farm.
Okay.
And they are just super lovely, wonderful people. And they have, they employ, you know, quite a bit of people. And, you know, in a small town like that in the North Country, they really are an economic driver
up
there.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Now, we know that, you know, over the years, the number of dairy farms have declined over the state. How about the number of cows? I mean, has that, you know, proportionally gone down as well? Or how does that work?
Sure. Yeah, the number of cows will go down along with that, obviously. You know, if you have a 100-cow dairy go out of business, you know, some of the cows will leave the state. Thankfully, most of the time, those cows will stay in the milking system, but they may be sold to a dairy producer in New York or Maine or Vermont. The good news here, and I hate to call it good news, so let's break this down based on product level. In terms of fluid milk consumption and production, those numbers tend to stay relatively even when we do see a dairy producer go out of business. And this sort of gets back full circle to our discussion about cow care, and that dairy farmers are very efficient in terms of how they progress and how they advance their farms. So, you know, the nutritionists that they have on the farms, yes, cows have personal nutritionists, must be nice, right? Between veterinary care and, you know, playing music in the barns and sand bedding or water beds, all of that leads to more milk production from a cow. Because when you're comfortable and happy, you're not stressed, so you're going to give more milk, which eventually leads to the fact that it is absolutely devastating to lose a farm. But in terms of fluid milk production, that tends to stay the same. Of course, we'll see that decline over a period of time, but it's not a huge, huge issue that people would think it is.
What kind of music do cows like? Or does it vary? Classical?
Classical.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was thinking R&B. I don't...
Well, I mean, the official studies are classical, but I have heard that certain radio stations, I won't mention one,
Feltus
but I
and
think
Cow.
They're both...
Yes, WKXL.
There are speakers in the barns, and rumor has it that there are certain voices that cows respond well to. They really are very much like people. A baby calf is very much like a human toddler. You can't tell them anything. You can't make them do anything. It is what it is. Then you get up into a heifer. Picture a teenager. They're that ornery. It's like, could you control yourself? Could you listen? No. And then you get up into the milking age, and, you know, they're just happy and docile, and they just go with the flow, which is great.
Go with the flow.
No pun intended.
I'm sure there was. I think there was, Amy, but we'll let it go this time. You have a Facebook page as well, Granite State Dairy Promotion, and you have a great video up there, which I saw yesterday on your Facebook page, of a moose visiting a dairy farm.
Isn't that the coolest video?
Yeah, it really is. It really is.
It just speaks to even more of the benefits of our dairy producers, right? I mean, you just have moose crossing, literally. You know, this wide open field, you know, he roamed in. You could see in that video the ladies in the barn checking him out. And I think the funniest part of that is that if you can identify a bull versus a dairy cow, there is one in that pen who said, I don't know about you, buddy. Why don't you keep moving along here? Move right along, Mr. Moose.
Was that in New Hampshire?
It was in New Hampshire, and I wish that I could reveal the name of the farm. But unfortunately, one of the things that dairy producers do have to deal with sometimes is that will invite unwanted visitors onto their farm who don't seek permission or ask permission to use their land. So that's sort of a sad reality that, you know, the farm said you can post the video, but please don't release our name because we don't want to have to deal with certain levels of disrespect that can often happen.
Well, that is a classic video that people should check out on your Facebook page. That is terrific.
Absolutely. And I also would like to encourage people to follow us on Instagram as well. We are at NH Dairy, and we post a lot of great facts up there, some beautiful pictures of cows, things that words can't express. You know, pictures often, you know, tell a thousand stories that words could never tell.
Very true. Well, Amy, always great to chat with you, and it's always a lot of fun and informative, and we will talk to you very soon.
Thank you.
Thanks,
you too,
Amy.
Enjoy this beautiful weather.
All right, Amy.
Yeah, you too.
You as well.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Amy Hall, Executive Director, Granite State Dairy Promotion. Our lead sponsor here on Feltus and Kale. I do want to remind you that a third round of COVID vaccine applications, if you will be taking place at New Hampshire Motor Speedway this weekend. And they've done a great job there. But you have to have an appointment in order to get a vaccination this weekend at New Hampshire Motor Speedway. And they will be vaccinating this Saturday and Sunday from 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. on Saturday and Sunday, and eligible individuals should visit nh.gov/COVID-19, nh.gov/COVID-19, and the New Hampshire Motor Speedway, the fifth Speedway Motorsports facility to serve as a vaccination site during the pandemic. So hats off to them and all the other Speedway motorsports facilities around the country that are doing such a great job in this vaccination process.
Yeah, thank you for doing that. You know, I think it was a great, great partnership, no doubt about it.
No doubt about it. And of course, racing will return in July to New Hampshire Motor Speedway. So that is just about going to wrap it up. Put a ribbon on it for this edition.
Put a ribbon on it.
Yeah, put a ribbon on it. Feltus and Kale, 1039 1450 WKXL, your home for Boston Celtics basketball, and of course, NewHampshireTalkRadio.com. Feldis and Kale is proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers.